Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
Also, Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
It's the same day. The same basement?
2 weeks later.
The same very attractive co-host.
Oh. And we're on a little bit of a high right now.
We are a little bit.
Kate and I just booked a little girls' night.
We did.
So that we have about probably, what, 30 hours away into reality at a spa.
Mm-hmm.
We've never done this.
No, it's going to be awesome. Devin and I don't ever do this, have never done this in our lives, so it'll be a very well-deserved
Kate break. And I also realized that in almost our 20 years of friendship, we've never gone away together.
No, literally never.
That's probably because at least 5 years of that friendship, we did live together.
We did. So
that was like our getaway.
Why would we have done that?
Why would we do a getaway?
Get away together.
From what already seems like a getaway.
That was a vacation in and of itself.
But it's been what? 14 years
Something
since we've
like
lived
that.
Together?
Yeah.
So it's time. We adore our husbands.
We do.
We love our family. But there's nothing like a little girl time.
Yeah.
And another plug. I'm plugging a lot.
Okay.
Like, I plugged a book in the last episode. Speaking of girl time and girlfriends, Firefly Lane. Anybody out there?
She's been trying to get me to watch this over the past hour as well.
I was going to say, she's saying it like I've been pushing her, but legit, it was like 2 hours ago I mentioned it to her. If you have that person in your life, just watch Firefly Lane.
I've heard very good things. People are obsessed with that show.
Everybody needs a Kate and Tully.
Yeah.
I.e. Kate and Devin.
100%.
Anyway, here we are.
Here we are.
Episode 3.
Episode 3 of our series of Dr. Satan.
I hope you guys are enjoying it as much as we are. Like, it's going by a lot quicker for us because we're recording all of this in the same time span of what's going to be a week.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be a while before I hear the final part 4,
mm-hmm.
but
yeah.
It's intriguing.
It is.
It's intriguing.
I know.
And it's interesting, just all the different parts to fully grasp the time period.
Yeah.
Like I had no idea that I was going to be able to link one of my favorite books to this show, you know?
And what?
But when you started talking about it, I'm like, wait a minute, I know about this.
And it was, what you had to say about it was super interesting and super helpful because I had read a little bit just in the context of this case, but you had a better understanding because you had read that. So I appreciate you helping out.
We all got a little bit of knowledge.
We all got a little bit.
Before we get into episode 46, part 3 of Dr. Satan, we have some Patreons.
We do.
Who also made it in just in time for the Patreon giveaway.
Sure did. We love you guys. We have Valerie Gibbons.
Welcome, Valerie.
We love ya. Ellen Corbett.
Ellen Corbett. Oh, yeah. I love that name.
I know. Get ready for this name. Candace Fox.
That's an excellent name.
I know. And you three are sexy manticores.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty sure that manticores are like, they have like the body of a lion and the head of a lion, but also they fly.
Whoa.
So that's what you guys are because
you're flying lions.
Because
I mean, if anything screams sexy, it's that.
You're also very powerful. Not just sexy, but powerful. Oh, God.
Thank you, everybody, for your feedback and everything. It's been great.
Yeah, it really has. We've really been loving this whole series, and it's just been a great vibe. And we're getting great feedback, so maybe we'll bring you some more series in the future.
We're getting great feedback. The Patreon support has been wonderful.
Oh,
we're really hoping that you guys are getting the value out of being part of our Patreon family, not just between giveaways, but that you're seeing our show grow.
Yes.
In quality. Mm-hmm. So if anyone was to go back and that hadn't started from the beginning and listened to our first episode to where we are now.
Yes.
Our growth is because of you. We've been able to increase our equipment, increase our knowledge and technical support and all of that stuff because of you guys.
So we really appreciate you all. And yeah, if you go back and listen to like episode one and then, you know, now
it's vastly different.
It's vastly different. We've learned a lot and we still learn. I still learn every time I edit, you know, another new trick or another new shortcut or something else that I shouldn't have done. And oh, I can't fix that. I guess I'm going to have to do better next time.
Our new sound partition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Patreons. Thank you, Patreons. Our listeners. We love you. So
here we go.
Part
what did they find in the house?
I know. I left you guys on like, I think that's the worst cliffhanger I've ever subjected you guys to.
So we need for those that didn't just finish wrapping up an hour ago, and this is 2 weeks later, we need a brief synopsis.
Oh, you'll get one. So if you haven't listened to part one, please do. I'm not going to recap all of that along with this. I recapped it in the beginning of part two, but just... if you're listening to this, you should have already listened to parts one and two. Let's be honest.
You start at the very beginning.
Yes. It's a very good place to start, as we decided.
When you read, you begin with ABC.
So, Marcel Petiot has lost his mayoral title. He's no longer the mayor of that tiny town he was living in. He moves with his family and reestablishes his practice in Paris. France! So he moves to Paris. Unfortunately, you know, he does well in his medical practice initially, but these little legal things keep catching up with him because he keeps just doing shady shit all the time for financial gain. And something happens wherein Germany occupies France, and it creates this very hostile environment for French citizens. And we talked a lot about it in part two. So he kind of shifts a little bit extremist, and he joins this group of resistance fighters. And following an arrest for some drug charges, he moves, you know, he kind of graduates away from his medical career a little bit. He does see some patients, not a whole lot, because he has now formulated this scheme with some friends of his to promise safe passage via an escape network for political refugees. And he collected fees from them, and instead of actually getting them to a safe place, he would murder them by injecting them with cyanide and presumably some other compounds, although that's not been confirmed.
For a little bit there, I'm like, oh, he's doing the right thing, right? He's part of an extremist and whatever, but in the grasp of World War II, coming up with this part of the resistance with wanting to help people escape.
Yeah, he's not.
You had that glimmer of hope.
You did. Just and for then, a second, though.
Mm-hmm. And then?
And then no.
No.
Nothing happens.
No.
So.
It makes, and in my mind, you are worse than a Nazi. There's not much that's worse than a Nazi.
He is, though.
He is. Mm-hmm. Clearly. Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Agreed. He also has been disposing of the bodies in various ways, dumping some in the Seine River. Others, he is disposing them in his boiler, in his furnace at his home, which is the notorious 21 Rue Le Cerf address in Paris, which is sort of right central in the town, actually very close to L'Arc de Triomphe. So neighbors complain of strange smells, crazy smoke activity. Eventually, authorities present themselves at the house because of all the disturbances and make a gruesome discovery, which we will finally start getting into. Trigger warnings for this episode: gruesome deaths, dismemberment. There is also mention of children being involved, as well as possibly sexual abuse. And we are continuing along this theme, including anti-Semitism, Nazism, because of the political climate. Mm-hmm. So, they found an absolutely massive amount of disturbing stuff, and we're going to go through what they discovered kind of systemically. I'm going to start with what they found outside the home, and we'll move inside. So, there was this small sort of fenced yard and courtyard behind the house, between his house and a few other properties. And in this courtyard, police found several piles of lime. And the first pile they sifted through immediately revealed piles of skulls, tibias, broken thigh bones,
goodness.
Humeruses, and other human debris of all kinds. While sifting through the first pile and continuing to do that, the four officers were assigned to sort of painstakingly, very carefully go through that. And they became so upset by what they found that police had to call in a grave digger to assist them with the recovery of the remains. So
this is the heavy part of the story.
This is where things get heavy. Ooh. Yep. This whole episode is heavy. So as Devin puts it, buckle your seats.
Now my head's in my hand. My high that I just had is gone.
Yeah,
I can feel it leaving.
I know it's leaving. I'm sorry. We can talk about the spa again later. We'll get pumped up again. So the gravedigger is there helping them sort of pour through these piles of lime. Now, they found another pile of lime sort of at the back of the courtyard area that was 6 feet high, about 8 or 9 feet long. So like a pretty good size pile. Inside that pile were, of course, more human remains. And they were in various stages of decomposition. They also found personal items, mostly clothing, jewelry, a lot of women's items, which we'll get more into. Now, it was customary back in that day in Paris that women who purchased clothes, oftentimes women would have their clothes made. They didn't make massive quantities of clothes like they do now that you just buy off the rack. If you want a dress, you buy fabric, you go get it made. And they would stitch your name onto a tag.
Okay.
So a lot of what was recovered from the scenes had the name tags cut off, ripped off, or if it was embroidered in there, someone tried to pick out the stitching. So,
making it even more harder to be able to identify all these people.
Exactly. And as you've probably guessed, you know, actually identifying a lot of these people was impossible.
I mean, they didn't have the technology to be able to do it. The DNA stuff didn't really come, we've talked about the 90s?
Yeah, so not even close to DNA.
Right.
And a lot of these people, again, were like, you know, Jews that were in hiding. Mm-hmm. And like, they weren't necessarily living like out and loud. Right. And a lot of times wouldn't carry identification. And so, again, you know, a lot of trouble with identifying these people. So nearby in that same courtyard, they also found a wheelbarrow, which was dusted with lime and also very dark stains. They found work clothes, like a jumpsuit, like a full like onesie jumpsuit one would wear to like work, you know, that was stained, you know, all on the front, on the cuffs with dark stains appearing to be blood, as well as dusted with lime. And by the time everything was accounted for outside the building, the report states that police had enough body parts to construct 10 complete human beings.
Oh.
And these were not all necessary from the same people, but they had enough parts.
They had enough, like,
yes,
arms, legs, chests, ribs, all that, like,
all
to
that.
Put 10 people together.
Yes.
They might not have matched them all.
Exactly.
But they had 10. Oh, my gosh.
So
that is a puzzle you do not want to imagine.
No, you do not want to be like the medical examiner here because it's just so chilling. The following involves children, so skip ahead the next 30 seconds or so if need be. When police and firemen entered the building, initially there was a concern of a chimney fire. We had mentioned that, right? So the boiler was cranking. Upon extinguishing the blaze that was in the boiler, they saw what was quite literally a small child's hand hanging from the door of the boiler. And beside the boiler was a pile of coal and ash with human bones mixed in. Sifting through the stuff in the boiler, obviously they found many more bones, jaws, hair, and other human components that were not fully disintegrated by the blaze. So officials who investigated the scene later reported that they had never seen anything like this and hope to never see anything like it again.
This essentially downtown Paris concentration camp.
That's exactly what it was.
Because they did the gas chamber. Yeah. They burned them.
Mm-hmm. It's essentially the same on a smaller scale.
Oh.
Many investigators and police and people that were investigating the scene and, you know, trying to recover these remains left the scene like physically ill. Just
how traumatizing for them.
Yes. And it was just so grisly and, you know.
You're anticipating going and dealing with like a chimney fire, a gas leak, something.
Yeah.
And then this is what you encounter.
And that's the reality for a lot of police and firefighters and first responders that work today. You have no idea what you're going to encounter.
Yes.
And, you know, you never expect that that's the day that you're going to, you know, end up in a shootout or end up discovering something like this. It's just, thank you, all first responders.
I was just going to say, here's their turn for their little shout out.
Yes, we love you guys.
Because, and, you know, oh, man, you just never know. You could expect the call and you have to prepare for the worst.
Exactly.
Whew.
So. Of note, every single body and body part that was found on this property was nude. All of the clothing had been removed. This was something that investigators sort of, they found it interesting, and they kind of took it and ran with it. And then later on, we'll see how in the media, Marcel starts getting painted as like a sexual sadist because, partly because of that.
If you're just going to, you wanted to get the money, kill them, and burn them, you just leave the clothing on.
Exactly.
It's part of the evidence.
And was it, you know, him trying to be really careful and, you know, separate the bodies from any identifiable items? Maybe, but I don't know, we'll get into it, but there's weirder stuff. So other discoveries on the property would further substantiate this whole sexual sadism thing. So he did have a small medical office within this building that he saw some patients in. So he wasn't practicing a lot anymore, but he would see the occasional patient. On his office wall, he had a fake diploma from the French medical school in Paris, which is not where he graduated from. That was fake. His office contained multiple drug compounds, needles, syringes, surgical instruments. Not all of that is unusual. I mean, he would have, you know, needed that in a medical office. Investigators noticed, however, that some of his decor choices were interesting. In his medical office, there was a giant wooden sculpture of a penis or like a phallus that it was found. It was just like there out in the open and it was huge. And Petio claimed to have carved that himself and like polished it himself.
And again, those types of art, right? It's just, I mean, unless you were, you know, doing.
Hey, I'm not
David,
judging.
You know what
you're
I mean?
Into like, what unless... you're into. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Where you're into what you're into. Like, that's fine. It's just like your medical office where strangers are walking in. Like, that would make me uncomfortable as a patient if my doctor had like an artistic penis just like sitting in the waiting area or whatever, you know? So it was just like kind of a interesting choice for a doctor's office.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a medical model that we see like of uteruses and stuff.
It wasn't an art gallery photo of David, the statue of David, you know, like it wasn't.
It was just a big wooden penis. So they did find in the medical office a suitcase, which was heavily stained with dark red and brown stains appearing to be blood. And it contained a couple of women's items, like a nail file, or what were considered to be women's items back then, a nail file. And there were some sharp knives and surgical instruments in it as well. And on this, so they walk into the building and there's a staircase right by the front entrance. And on the staircase, they found a canvas sack full of just dismembered human body parts.
Just in a bag.
Just in a sack. Just there. Just sitting there. Presumably like the next sack that needs to be brought down into the boiler. Now I'll make a quick note. Again, when I'm saying police and investigators, we have the two competing sides here. So France still has their own police and investigators, but Germany has taken things, certain things over within the country.
Okay.
There is still,
so they have their folks too.
They do. So they have there's a heavy French resistance still. That's very real. And French police are involved in the initial investigation. However, Germany also had their own presence and their own sort of legal system within the country. And the French people in general, or most of them, actually would favor or sympathize with the resistance. So, I mean, that's a lot of that's a big number of people. So there's a pretty strong competing force between the French resistance and the Gestapo, which again is like the German presence within the country.
Because they want to override anything that's going on in France.
Exactly. And the Gestapo's goal is to extinguish the resistance.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, that's their primary goal.
Well, because they're fighting against them.
Exactly. So just like today, I mean, a lot of the social issues and the current events, everyone, you know, takes a political side.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all political. Everything becomes political in that moment.
Everything.
So even the discovery of these bodies and this grisly murder that blew up in the media, of course, became political. So back to what we find in the house. So they're starting to go room to room here. They find more stained suitcases. In one room in particular, they found a slew of women's belongings and clothing. Again, having been, you know, stripped of any identification marks, along with more nail files, purses, undergarments, lipstick, jewelry, just some stuff that women may have on them if they're mm-hmm. planning to travel. And it was not as if these were just like hidden away or shoved in a corner. Like, somebody like painstakingly folded them, cleaned them, sorted them, organized them, like as if this was my trophy room of women's items. There were even some things, like the fancier things, like there were some really like nice beaded dresses and stuff that he had that were somewhat on display. Like, they were, like, hanging on the wall. So, yeah, all kinds of just really disturbing, alarming, jarring
stuff. It makes you, like, for what purpose? Like, right. When it's on display, like, display for you? Did you want other people to see that?
Right.
What was the intent behind it?
Exactly. It's just really, it makes you wonder, like, what the real motive was there. Because, like, from a psychology standpoint, like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, other people are,
it's more than just antisocial.
Way more.
It's way more.
Like, there's a deep, like, psychopathy there.
With the, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, some other things that they found, again, are further substantiating this idea that he was maybe a sexual sadist. They identified several jars within the home which contained human genitals.
I was waiting for you to say that.
Yeah. Male and female. Preserved in formal, which was sort of an early formaldehyde.
So just jars of
dicks and vaginas.
And testicles?
I guess. I didn't Google a picture. So now we're going to move down to the basement.
Oh, God. It always gets worse in the basement.
Why is it always so bad in the basement?
It's always worse in the basement.
Basements are creepy by themselves. We spend a lot of time in this basement.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we don't
need to. Speaking of the basement.
Yeah, we don't need to add severed, you know, limbs and stuff.
There's nothing on display in Kate's basement.
Except a bicycle and a furnace and an exercise bike that is deeply unused.
And wherever that big giant pumpkin is.
So they head into the basement. There were tables and tools. Tables and tools. The tables were like these big embalming tables. So they had like channels and then a drain in the middle. And there was like obvious like blood staining there. And there were tools that were, you know, of course, covered in blood, like surgical tools, and hatchets and saws and things that they would presumably use to process these bodies. Yep. So presumably what would happen, some of them get brought in, then sort of processed or dismembered, and then be burned in parts, essentially. There were more clothes. There were more nude body parts.
It was essentially his operating room.
Yes.
Like that was like where he just...
like a really shitty, terrible operating room. This is giving me Josef Mengele, you know, vibes.
This is telling me we need to get out of the basement.
We need to leave this basement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now the search continues into their two-car garage. And the garage, the floor of the garage had been dug out into like a giant pit. And the pit was full of lime. It was like this massive pit of lime. They, you know, start sifting through that because they know what they're going to find. And they found even more body parts and even intact corpses, like totally intact.
Just hadn't been touched
just
yet.
Nude and in there, all in various stages of decomposition.
Were their genitals off? Cut off?
I didn't
might have
read
been in the jar upstairs.
Didn't read that they were. Who knows? So this search continues to unfold. Petio returns to the house finally with his wife, Georgette, and they're now two kids. They've had another baby. They had a daughter at some point. He sees that authorities are already in the home and, of course, immediately goes on the defensive, like twisting things
I'm sorry.
Around.
There's no defense that would cover that. There's no deflection.
Yeah.
That would the that would do the stuff in the boiler, the genitals in the jar, the blood on the hacksaws, essentially.
I know.
I'm curious to hear what his defense was.
And you will.
Please tell me.
So he starts making up crazy stories, and he's using the political environment.
Someone put those there.
Yeah, no. He's not going quite that far, but he's using the political environment to his advantage. And he starts saying that he is a very high up member of the French Resistance, and the bodies are all German authorities and German soldiers and German officers and administrators and collaborators and German spies.
Crap. That's bull crap.
And
so wait, all of this was in their house?
In one of their houses. They
one
owned
of their
multiple
houses.
Properties.
That's right, they did. Because
yep.
I was going to say, wifey?
The prior, the primary residence was at a different location.
Yeah.
And we will get
yeah.
into that
okay.
as well.
Oh boy.
Yep. So, of course, you know, none of this was true. These were not Germans and German soldiers. He did that because he knew that the primary investigators were the French. The bulk of the French people were the resistance, and he wanted at least, you know, some political favor in
this. He wanted people on his side.
He wanted people on his side and say, oh, this guy's the resistance, and he's fighting the power, and he's...
Good for
I
you,
mean,
man.
Either way, does that make murder okay? No. But again, these are the extremist groups. So,
and essentially, I mean, in the time period that you're living with, it really is do or die.
Exactly.
And if you're found helping anybody that's in hiding, like you're at risk for being murdered yourself.
Exactly. There was at this point a big crowd gathering at the house. And back then, what they would do if somebody passed away or was killed is they would dispatch coffins to the house for like the removal of corpses. And so people just watched in awe as coffin after coffin after coffin were removed from this house. Now, French police hear this from Petio. They hear that these are all Germans. And this is where, you know, I have a real hard time, like, kind of understanding exactly what went down, because French authorities, whom in general are sympathizers with the resistance, hear that Petio was killing Germans and collaborators and spies, and they say, oh, okay, that's cool, and are reluctant to arrest him.
Come on.
This was documented.
Come on.
This was literally documented. My question.
To not even like arrest and then release when it's found.
Like you haven't investigated anything. This is just this guy's saying. This is just him saying that these are Germans. My question is, explain the child's hand that was found.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What did that child do What did that child do to interfere with the resistance then?
Right.
Was this child a German spy? I don't fucking think so.
Right. Right.
He's a tool. He's an absolute tool.
And nobody questioned this.
Nobody. Exactly. Nobody. That's why I'm like, I'm having a real hard time wrapping my head around the cascade of events here, because there was literally the remains of a child in that furnace. Mm. Why? So anyway, I digress. Mm. The formal investigation begins. Interviews are starting to be conducted so that they can sort of piece all this stuff together.
Meanwhile, he's free. He's so free. He's figuring out his shit.
He's chilling.
Like how to get out of this even
further.
He's
just thinking, I'm Marcel Petiot and I'm going to get the fuck out of this.
I can't be legally held responsible for anything I do.
Exactly.
I have the paperwork to prove it.
And then I'm just going to have a psychiatric breakdown and then get better.
And be out in 7 months.
No problem. So when police are starting to interview neighbors and people he knew and patients of his, neighbors stated that they often saw men and women coming and going carrying suitcases to the house, as well as like big carts or large trunks.
Well, yeah, if they're traveling, getting ready to cross over.
Well, what it actually was were his accomplices and his wife.
What?
Bringing the stained suitcases and stained trunks, likely containing bodies or body parts, to this house to then be disposed of.
What?
Mm-hmm.
To which house?
To the 21 Rue Le Sur. Yeah. So.
But wait a minute. Yeah. That's where people were going to get their vaccine.
Not necessarily, no. And we'll get into it. So he had several properties, and he very seldom brought anyone directly to this house to initially.
Okay. Yep. So then this house is where they were disposed of.
Most likely.
Not where it was like all in one done.
Right.
Got it.
Oftentimes the deeds.
That's why you have the trunks and stained things coming and going, because they're bringing. Understand.
Got it.
Wow.
Got it.
Pieces.
Yes.
Trying to connect all the pieces. Mm-hmm.
Now, he did have a medical office there that he saw patients at. But neighbors also said that they did sometimes hear women talking or arguing from time to time coming from this house. So he did bring people here sometimes initially, followed by brief screams for help, then periods of silence.
You would think
somebody, anybody,
but
can we,
if call I someone? Was, if I was in the thought process of Marcel and I have multiple residences, I probably wouldn't use the one that's downtown Paris. They didn't have one where there was no neighbors worried that their place was going to blow up with a gas leak. They chose
downtown, literally around the corner.
Where people walk by
all
the time.
There's a lot of interesting choices here. And
for
a man
like that, you would think that's not the best location.
So it's not. But also, I think that Marcel Petiot truly and genuinely believed he was invincible and could get out of anything and explain anything away.
So who gives a fuck?
He was a narcissist. And he thought very highly of himself, and no one, you know, I can do whatever I want and no one's going to get me. That's what I think that comes from. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that the neighbor accounts almost never mentioned that when they were hearing these voices and these scuffles, that there were male voices. A lot of what was heard were female voices.
Hmm.
And
so who other than his wife was helping out?
Well, it's either that or these were some of the victims, and the vast majority of them were women. Of course, there were multiple reports among the neighbors that he was just burning at all hours constantly. And then they got a hold of, they had heard from a patient who recently saw Petu, like within the weeks leading up to this, went to his office at that house. She noticed a smell in the home and was like, this is gross. She went to see him because her wrist was bothering her. And she told investigators that she, quote, narrowly escaped with her life, end quote, in sort of like a half-joking way. Because she reported that, you know, he was smart. He took really good care of me and he seemed to know what he was doing. He took an X-ray of her wrist and diagnosed her with a sprain and prescribed some calcium tablets for her, quote unquote, weak bones and gave her a sling and sent her on her way. But his appearance was what was very jarring. She said he literally looked like a serial killer, like literally, and he was. So his hair was a mess. His eyes were wild. He was flushed. He had dark stains on his pants and the cuffs of his jacket were all stained.
So he essentially was on the brink of like...
like a break.
A break. Breakdown.
Yeah.
Losing it because he's been able to hide that facade by so long by staying behind
and
his
crumbling.
Appearance.
And yes. Starting to crumble. And she also said that his jacket was dusted with what looked like lime. So that was an interesting account. Now, based on some witness testimonies and interviews, investigators were able to conclude that the two men who were supposed to testify against Petio a couple years ago in that drug trial were last seen entering the Petio home at 21 Rue Le Sueur and were never seen leaving the home. So I think we can all infer what happened to those two informants.
So then this was going on for years.
Oh, yeah. This was 2 years. Around 2 years this happened.
Wow.
So witnesses also reported again seeing his accomplices and even his wife, Georgette, coming and going, transporting these heavy suitcases and heavy trunks to the home. So again, while this is unfolding, Petio is a free man. His accomplices are free. His wife is free, who were all, you know, very much involved in what was going on. You can't tell me that they didn't know what was up and what they were carrying in their suitcases.
Right.
I mean,
right.
So the media gets a hold of this. And
you might not have all your stuff you need for a conviction, but you have all your stuff you need to hold him to make sure he doesn't run off.
Oh, 100% you do. Come on now. Now, the media gets a hold of this. And of course, he is painted, rightly so, as a monster, a vampire, a sexual sadist. And even though the true extent of his crimes had really yet to be understood until his trial like really started, and the media at the time has a big influence from Germany and the Gestapo.
Right, of course, yeah.
And of course, you know, Petio was going around saying that these are crimes against Germans, that he did this purposefully as part of the resistance to commit crimes against Germans. So the Gestapo is furious that he's out walking around.
Right.
And is calling for his immediate arrest. So again, this is getting very political. And
another French protecting him at this point?
A little bit. Mm. A little bit. So they're calling for his arrest. And nevertheless, they had accused France of allowing this dangerous maniac to like walk the streets, which they literally
are
doing. They are.
They are. Yeah.
Like, you don't even know what this guy really did. And you're just like, that's okay. You said it was Germans that you killed. So I suppose you can just walk around and...
Oh, boy.
You know.
Right.
So as a response to German pressure, the French police commissioner, Georges Victor Massu, was appointed as the lead investigator on the case. And his first task was to kind of try and determine, okay, though, is Petio killing for the resistance or is he killing for the Gestapo?
Right.
But
who's
nobody
he, who's
really
he working for?
He's not working for anybody.
But himself.
The reality is that he's just killing people for financial gain and he doesn't give a fuck who he's killing.
Yeah.
So this investigation continues. Police eventually start searching Petio's other properties. and he has a primary residence in an apartment, which is across town. And that's the first location they start searching. They find, you know, a bunch of drug compounds, including a ton of narcotics. They find digitalis, which is digoxin. Yeah. It's a cardiac glycoside, more cyanide, and chloroform. Not all of this, again, is that unusual. The chloroform may be a little unusual, but, I mean, all stuff that he could technically explain away.
As a physician.
Exactly.
Physician.
Mm-hmm. Now, people who Petio and his gang tried to recruit for their scheme and then failed to recruit them start coming forward and telling their stories, because this is all in the media. And most of them were Jews. And authorities are starting to get these reports from not German people, but Jews and people that were like refugees and trying to escape with their lives, and realizing that, okay, this guy and his lackeys tried to get, like, tried to lure this guy in and failed.
But they're also, they're putting themselves at risk too, because if they're saying that they knew about this, that they knew about the resistance in this port of exit, or this supposed port of exit, that leaves also the Gestapo to come and get them for things that are completely surrounding the climate right now that have nothing to do with Petio.
Exactly. Exactly right. And that's where this just takes a weird, that's exactly, you know, taking a weird turn, because now the Germans get wind of, well, was this guy actually, you know, funneling Jews out of the country?
Right.
And
because now they want them.
Exactly. And so with that information, the German police commissioner arrests him on suspicion of funneling Jews out of the country. Again, nothing to do with the murders. Oh, but it crosses the line that you were trying to, you know, help, presumably help people, and maybe that you have an escape network. That crosses the line. Murder, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
So before they even put it together that these were the same people that he was recruiting that were then murdered, and it was all a financial scam. So
yeah,
you've crossed both sides. Exactly.
You know, the French and the Germans disagree on so much, but that right there,
exactly,
that's crossing both sides.
So that's where this gets muddy, because now they're all just like focusing on the possibility that he has an actual escape network that he's working with. They also arrest his wife, Georgette, and all of the accomplices along with them.
What do you think happened to get Georgette on board?
That's a great question. I wish I knew.
I mean, you never know things behind closed doors, but how did she go from little housewife mother to being an accomplice in all this?
I know.
And maybe she was always just as whacked as he is, you know? I'm interested in that. Like,
oh yeah.
You know,
and maybe
for the
we'll
7 months that she was, for the 7 months that he was inside, you know, and she's begging for his release. I need my husband. She's with her. I wonder how she got involved.
I think that, like you said, a lot happens, you know, behind closed doors that we'll just never understand. But I think that Petio is so ridiculously manipulative and narcissistic that she was the right exact type of personality for him to do this to. And maybe that's why he chose to marry her, because he knew that he could get her to do
anything, whatever
he needed.
Right.
Which is so sad for her if she really got entangled in this, kind of just trying to be a supportive wife or manipulated into it. So, Petio and his wife and his people are under arrest. The German authorities are investigating these allegations, and they discover that this escape network that they were advertising did not actually exist, and they had absolutely no means of removing people from the country, but that many people who contacted them for assistance would then disappear, never to be seen again. So what are you doing with these people?
Yep.
Under interrogation, Georgette, his wife, as well as the accomplices, including his best friend, Mr. Nezonde, admit to assisting with the financial transactions and moving suitcases and trunks between his properties. And it would appear many people would be seen and like entering the properties as well, presumably following victim to Petio there and then never being seen again, for lack of a better term.
Right.
Like they would just disappear and no one would ever see these people leave. And then people would leave with like suitcases and trunks, different people. And it was kind of like people were falling victim to Petio at any one of his properties, including 21 Rue Le Sur, and then eventually, if they weren't already there, being moved there for quote unquote processing and disposal, for lack of a better term. Wild.
Wild.
So, we're going to discuss the coroner's examination of the remains coming up just so you know.
Okay.
It's not terrible, but just if you're not into that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the medical examination of the remains revealed that between the hundreds of bones and body parts found within the home, they could identify at least 23 separate bodies that these bones all came from.
Wow.
Like they were able to puzzle piece together 23 distinct people.
Right. So even though they had made 10 skeletons,
yes,
essentially, when they laid them all
those
out,
those were not necessarily belonging to the same person.
Right. They essentially have body parts of 23 different people.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that wild? Mm. And these are, you know, just what was in the house at that time.
Not even what was already disposed of.
Right. Or dumped in the Seine River.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So when they were looking at these bones, many of the longer bones were cut in the middle, like a lot of the femurs, the humeruses were sort of cut in the middle. And that's how they could piece things together, as they could match, you know, end to end the cut. A lot of the bones had various saw marks on them, like they would have tried to cut in the middle, you know, at one spot, then tried again somewhere else. Often, this is rough, often the legs would be, like, disarticulated at the joints, like at the hips, and then at the knee joints also. The majority of the bodies found were women. They did find some men and, of course, children within this collection, but the vast majority were female.
That's not completely surprising either.
No.
I
don't think so either.
Because they were drafting the men.
Yeah.
You know.
That's true. There were more women that were
Or if they weren't drafted, maybe they were staying behind to fight with the resistance.
Right.
And sending the women and children off to safety.
Right.
And so he took the, you know, not that women are vulnerable, but in that time period, he's killing the vulnerable.
Yes. Absolutely, you're right. And unfortunately, the vast majority of the remains were disfigured and burned beyond any sort of recognizability. And many of these people were, again, undocumented or Jews in hiding. So we may never know the identities of a lot of these victims.
Do we know any of them?
So we'll get more into it in part four.
Okay.
But the body count... does not, again, account the many bodies that he tossed in the river. And investigators who were in the home had stated that they believe the number, the 23 that they have, is vastly inferior to the true number of victims that he had. And
didn't you say in part one it was like presumed 60-something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what they said, is that he is estimated to have killed at least 60 people.
Wow.
But just based on the amount of belongings he was hoarding,
right,
too. And, you know, these, you know, all came from somewhere. So, of note, down the line, some remains were also recovered from the river. And these were dismembered body parts, of course, without any identifiable features, which is super sad. families of missing people in the area had started to come forward also. And because now this is blowing up in the media that, okay, you know, it's getting reported that he was luring people that were in hiding with a fake network of escape. Mm. Well, you know, a lot of people actually received letters from their family members around the time that they vanished, stating that they were leaving the country and don't look for me and this and that. So
that's interesting, because I was about to bring up a point where I was like, well, then those poor families, because in the time period of what's mm-hmm. going on, there's many different things that could explain their vanishing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Did they end up in Germany mm-hmm. to a concentration camp because right. they were found in hiding?
Exactly.
Or did they make it to Petio and they actually got to go get out of the country and mm-hmm. go in a different way?
Exactly.
Like, and because they're not identifiable, you don't know.
Exactly.
You know, you don't know. And so then it was like wondering, are they even involved in this or not? But if they got that letter, mm-hmm. then it's like, okay.
Exactly.
They're definitely most likely part of that scheme.
Exactly. They get these letters saying, you know, don't come looking for me. It's not safe, but I'm going to be hiding out in, you know, South America or whatever. And these letters almost always struck the families odd because, like, either the writing style was very different than how they typically wrote or spoke, or that it would just be very out of character for them to, mm-hmm. you know, leave without them or something along those lines. So when this was coming out in the press, it started occurring to these families that, hey, maybe my daughter, you know, who disappeared a couple months ago was involved in this, or maybe my grandson was, you know, a part of this or what have you. So presumably he was writing letters, like that's fake awful. Letters to family members to throw them off the trail. And, mm-hmm. you know, these people who, you know, their families are thinking, great, you know, they're safe in, mm-hmm. you know, South America. And they actually were murdered in their own hometown. And this is giving me like Holmes vibes also with like the letter writing.
Oh,
remember?
Yeah, H.H. Holmes.
Yeah. So just as a picture of what actually went on, like, in this, with this scheme, is like it's all coming together. Like the media is now like grasping, and investigators are now grasping, like, you know, you're advertising this fake network and then killing these people, and there is
so
no actual network.
Have they arrested him? Like, at what point is he no longer
Germans,
a free man?
The Germans have him. The Germans
they do.
Have him still. Yep. So Marcel maintains, I'm killing for a cause. These are Germans. I have no idea what these other people are talking about. They weren't Jews. And this was all, you know, in self-defense, and I'm killing for the resistance. He's maintaining that. That is the hill he will die on.
Because he thinks that's his biggest way out.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. he thinks he's going to get the most support that way, and mm-hmm. that the French authorities won't persecute him if that's the case. Now, everything is suddenly brought to a screeching halt because the Normandy invasion begins. So this, of course, is an utter crisis for the country.
Mm-hmm.
All German forces are redispatched, as well as many French forces are redispatched out of Paris and onto the front lines for this battle. And for the time being, Marcel's case is put completely on hold.
Right.
And, you know, I'm sure everyone would love to focus on it, pursue it, but that's just, for them, is not right. an option. So 7 months go by. He's released because they have no means of keeping him and continuing this interrogation. He's released. 7 months go by. Petio hasn't been charged by Parisian officials with anything at all yet. And it has become apparent that he wasn't actually aiding and abetting Jews. So for that reason, he was released by Germany. They don't give a fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And his accomplices are walking free. Tune in next time.
Oh, man.
For the rest.
Oh, man.
I know.
So here we are at D-Day.
D-Day.
And you can't blame them, because that was like, we all
what
know.
What are they going to do?
D-Day encompasses all. Yeah. Like, and it's like, just... Well,
I guess you weren't killing I guess you weren't aiding and abetting Jews. You were actually killing them. So you guys can go. France can deal with you.
Yeah.
Hmm. Wild.
And France just doesn't have the resources.
No, I mean, neither does Germany in this moment. They're, right. You know, they're yeah. working on
all
some shit.
All resources are pulled.
Yeah.
Damn.
Isn't that wild?
He got luck of timing.
This guy has 48 lives.
And here we are, part three, and he's still a free man.
And he's still a free man. So part four will hopefully wrap up this wild, wild
I
want to
know how it ends. Like, I hope. Obviously, he's dead. I mean, he was born
he's
in the 1800s.
Yes.
But I want to know what the ending for him.
I know.
It's Am I going to be satisfied? Okay, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I was just going to say, somewhat. I hope I'm satisfied.
Somewhat satisfying.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Could have been more satisfying, but.
Thank you for sticking with us, everyone, through three parts.
We love you
This
guys.
Has been long, but it's intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're telling the story very well.
I am. Oh, thank you.
Are.
Because
you
are. With like the political
I'm engaged.
Stuff, I feel like I have very little, like really high level knowledge of like how politics work and government works.
But let me tell you, I'll put the plug in again, because once you got to this stage and what's going on in that area in this time period, me having read that novel was really like I fully was able to grasp mm-hmm. everything that you're talking about right now.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So again, read The Nightingale if yeah. this time period and this story is interesting to you.
Yeah.
I do believe I heard, because on the front of my book that I have, it says soon to be a motion picture.
Ooh, yeah.
Which I was really excited for, because again, favorite novel, but
very
they
cool.
might. You know, which one's better, the book or the movie?
Yeah.
But anyway, it I fully am like in this
awesome.
Story because I was so engulfed in that novel last year
wow.
that I was like,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. Okay. It was definitely one of those when it's over.
Mm-hmm.
Now what?
Gotcha.
And so now I'm getting
more now you're
of
getting
it.
A little tasty, tasty taste.
It's linked in the show notes.
Yes, it is.
Thank you again for sticking with us, everybody.
Oof.
If you want to keep checking us out, find us on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can tweet at us at Med Crimes PC or try. You can try.
We should start sticking TikTok in there instead of Twitter.
We should. We're at
we
Med
should
Crimes
do TikTok.
Podcast on TikTok. You should find us. Follow us. We're fun.
You should search for us on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
If you wish to become a Patreon, you can find us at www. Wow. I have a lot of trouble with the www. www.patreon.com. Let me start that over. You can find us at www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast.
I think this is your last chance to get in on the Patreon giveaway. I think this is your last
this
chance.
Might be it. This might be it.
I think it's coming.
Yep.
And if you want to be a part of our next episode, Break Room Banter, we want to see all of your crazy stories, anything that you care to tell, funny, scary, spooky, out of this world, medcrimes@gmail.com.
We need to know. We know you have the stories. Everybody does. Just
we
just
do.
Tell us.
So
just,
you, we know you do.
Just do it.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Stay safe out there.
Bye-bye.